Good afternoon. I'm Pat Morrison. Same issues, different players. The Screen Actors Guild contract expires at the end of June. And just like the Writers Guild, they want more from the DVD sales, and they also want some kind of deal when their product goes on the internet. The Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers has negotiations underway. They have not gone very far with the Screen Actors Guild, and it's complicated by the fact that the AFTRA Union, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, will be negotiating its contract separately. Joining me to talk about this, Jim Kennedy, spokesman for the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers. Mr. Kennedy, thank you very much.
Good afternoon.
What's the playbook this time around?
Well, basically, we had been wanting to have early negotiations with the Screen Actors Guild for a number of months now, and they had resisted that. However, AFTRA did agree to engage in early talks, so we had set up to begin negotiations with them, and then finally SAG decided to negotiate. And so we set up a two-week period of negotiations to accommodate them. And we also agreed to extend those negotiations on two occasions. However, the talks did not get very far, and out of respect for AFTRA, we did go back to the original agreement to negotiate with them, and those have begun.
So you are talking to AFTRA, you're not talking to SAG. Are the terms that SAG is asking for pretty much similar to what the Writers Guild was asking for?
Well, as you know, the Writers Guild and the Hollywood producers were very far apart for a long time, ultimately resulting in a strike. However, at the end of the day, they did come to agreement, particularly on the area of new media formulas, and created a framework that both sides, were happy with, and the directors as well came to a similar agreement, as did a part of AFTRA known as the Network Code negotiations as well. And so kind of a basic framework was reached around new media payments. However, the Screen Actors Guild has come in with proposals that, in our view, would essentially upset the apple cart and really cause turmoil and change things in too many ways. And so that's a big part of the difference.
How many apples are they asking for?
Well, it's complicated. For example, the Screen Actors Guild has said that they want to get some money for clips that are paid on the internet, and what we're saying is that such clips are already widely available on the web now, unfortunately, as a result of piracy, and so the actors want us to be forced to bargain separately with every performer in every clip, which would be a burdensome and expensive process, which would essentially not allow us to even explore that market. We even instead propose to make a fixed payment so that the actors do receive payment for the use of the clips on the internet. We think that's a more rational and reasonable way to go about exploring this market, because if we had to negotiate every single time with every single actor for every single clip, that market would never get developed by us and nobody would benefit.
What about DVD sales? What are they asking for?
Well, they had originally come in with a doubling and had downscaled that somewhat, but again, they've sought more than was sought in the other negotiations we've had with the writers and the directors. And we think there that, again, there's a bit of a gap there, which is really inhibiting our ability to reach an agreement. We hope they will observe and respect the kind of framework we've reached with the writers and the directors and some of the actors, and that we can reach a conclusion to this.
Jim Kennedy is spokesman for the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers. The contracts for the Screen Actors Guild scheduled to expire at the end of June. Likewise, for the Television Actors, Television and Radio Artists Union. Mr. Kennedy, how are negotiations proceeding with that organization? It's got about 70,000 members. Some of them also belong to the Screen Actors Guild.
Right, and again, it does get a little confusing. There was a so-called AFTRA Network Code agreement, a Network Television Code agreement, which already has been agreed upon and was actually last week ratified by AFTRA at a 93% margin of their members, which was encouraging. That basically covers actors and other on-camera and off-camera people in different kinds of reality shows and syndicated dramas and talk shows. Now what's underway now is the AFTRA so-called primetime TV contract for AFTRA. That covers the the primetime network TV dramas and situation comedies. So that those negotiations have commenced, and hopefully there'll be a good result there. I think everybody recognizes the damage that a strike can cause. We certainly witnessed it last year with the writer's strike, which cost the writers millions of dollars, but also really had a reverberating effect on others in the industry, including the wider economy. And since last fall, the economic situation has gotten worse with rising gas prices and the housing crisis and so forth. And I think having a strike in Southern California's one of their major industries at this time would be pouring gasoline on a fire and could be seriously disruptive. And that's not to mention the effect on audiences around the country. And I think we've seen in past economic downturns that people turn to entertainment for relief from the pressures of the day, whether it's TV shows or movies. And I think even at a psychological level, people would not be happy about that spigot of entertainment getting shut off because of this dispute.
Mr. Kennedy, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Jim Kennedy is a spokesman for the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers. Also joining us, Alan Rosenberg. He's the national president of the Screen Actors Guild. Mr. Rosenberg, thank you for joining me.
How are you, Pat?
Fine, thanks very much.
Good.
So you were listening to what was being said.
Yes.
We've gone through one round of negotiations. The strike had devastating results. What is it that SAG wants that you think is the sticking point?
Well, the writers and the directors only dealt basically with new media, with the future, and they didn't really talk about a lot of the things that affect actors in the present day today. And so there's a whole realm of issues that we needed to discuss that weren't even dealt with in the Writers Guild and the Directors Guild negotiation. As for the agreement that the WGA and the DGA reached in new media, I think Mr. Kennedy has our proposal a little bit wrong. The writers and the directors gave away the free use of clips, 5-minute, 10-minute clips on the internet, but they don't have the same concerns that actors do. We really concern ourselves with overexposure. We've had protections in our contracts for the last 50 years so that when an actor's work is reused in clip form in other media, actors are consulted and they're asked for their consent, and then they're compensated. Mr. Kennedy said that the issue was overcompensation. In fact, the MPTP is offering to compensate us some. It's not very much. Our concern is consent. The fact that they'll be able to take our content and mash it up and do whatever they want with from now until the end of time without getting consent from actors is very problematic for us. And writers and directors don't really have to worry about that. When you see a clip, you don't know who wrote it, you don't know who directed it, but you sure know whose face it is. And they have the ability now to attach products to these clips, to do whatever they want, to mash it up with other movies. You know, they use as an example Brokeback to the Future, where they mash up clips of Brokeback Mountain and Back to the Future and kind of bastardize and exploit that content in the actor's work. It's going on now. It's being pirated, but the studios want the ability to get into that business and to not compensate actors, but more importantly for me and for the Screen Actors Guild is not to consult with the actors and gain their consent. We're being asked to give away 50 years of protections that we've won for our members for new media, and the AMPTP says because this is a new business, they have to get into it. They need unfettered access to the internet. Our point of view is that now that millions and millions of people are going to be watching our work every day, the need for us to protect our members is even heightened.
Okay,
I don't know one actor or one agent or one manager in Los Angeles that I've talked to that doesn't agree with me.
Mr. Rosenberg, piracy is rampant, as you have both pointed out, and it is not in the interest of either you or the AMPTP. How do you go about, what would the logistics be of trying to regulate and control that and getting permission from actors to see their work put out in forms that aren't even controlled or regulated by really anyone?
Well, we're not asking them to control what happens with the end user. They have language in their license agreements, the AMPTP, when they give license to individuals to air their content, there's protections for their content. They don't want anyone to take a clip from Hannah Montana and put it on the air and make something out of softly pornographic out of it. They would protect that with everything they have. All we're asking for is the same protections. Once that piece of content goes out into the universe and an end user takes it and does anything with it, we know we can't protect against that. All we want is the same protections that the studios afford themselves. And like I said, we have these protections in our existing agreements. All it takes is at the time of hire, an actor checks off a box saying, are you willing to have your clip used? And an actor has the opportunity to say yes or no.
And so what Mr. Kennedy was saying, that it would require individual consultation with each performer per appearance in this new media, is not right?
No, that's not correct. There are ways to get it. And we've even offered the MPTP to help them, or even take on the burden of going out and finding those actors and gaining the consent.
Now, Mr. Rosenberg, the strike by the writers lasted something around 3 months, and it devastated the industry. It had an immense impact on the Los Angeles economy. How is that, the knowledge, the awareness, the memory of that playing out in this strike?
Well, people have been we understand that people are strike weary and they're tired and they're afraid, and nobody wants a strike. I've said that over and over again. Nobody in this town wants a strike less than I do. What we want to do is make a deal. And our members are very clear about what we went through a whole exhaustive wages and working conditions process where members from every discipline in our union came in and brought us their needs. We prioritized our proposals. And it's clear that as far as clip usage is concerned, as far as product integration is concerned, where now they're embedding commercials in the content inside of television shows and movies. They don't want to give actors the right to say yes or no to that either. You can have an actor who's 10 years sober to whom taking a drink of alcohol is anathema and force him to do a beer commercial within a movie, because they allow that kind of thing to go on inside movies without the ability to say, no, I can't do that. I use the extreme example of an East Indian actor being forced to take a bite of a hamburger and saying, I'm loving it, do a McDonald's commercial within a TV show or a movie. They're insisting that actors do that without being compensated, but more importantly, without being consulted or given the ability to say no, and that's just not American to me. So there's a real need for us to go out and fight for some of these things that our members need and want, and we really do. We thought we were making momentum. I'm very upset that we've stalled these negotiations when we have, because I really thought we were coming towards an agreement. And I was very disappointed the MPTP suspended these talks, because I thought we were close to an agreement without having to take a job action, without even having to go out to our members and get a strike authorization.
There's still a number of weeks before the deadline. Do you think something can break?
The AMPTP is they intend to get back into the room with us sometime near the end of May, and so we'll have another chance at the table. And I'm confident that our after brothers and sisters, and they're not even our brothers and sisters, just so everybody's clear, everybody in our negotiating committee, almost everybody in our negotiating committee, are also after members.
We're all
dealing with the same members here.
A lot of crossover. Mr. Rosenberg, I hope you'll come back as the negotiations progress, and I hope they will indeed progress.
Anytime.
Alan Rosenberg is the national president of the Screen Actors Guild. The actors' contract expires at the end of June. No new talks right now, but there should be new ones coming at the end of May to try to divert yet another strike in Hollywood. This is 89.3 KPCC. President Jimmy Carter is here next.
Programming is supported by the Wilshire Theater Beverly Hills, presenting Love, Janice, the life and music of Janis Joplin on stage in this new musical. Going behind the music and offering a glimpse at the soul of a legend through letters she wrote and her songs, Me and Bobby McGee and Mercedes-Benz come to life in this intimate portrayal inspired by the book by Laura Joplin. 5 performances, May 29th to June 1st at the Wilshire Theater, Beverly Hills.
It's 119. This is 89.3 KPCC. I'm Mark Thomas. Governor Schwarzenegger yesterday helped deliver boxes of petitions to the L.A. County Clerk's Office in Norwalk. They contained more than enough signatures to put his proposal for a redistricting reform on the November ballot. Schwarzenegger wants to create a 14-member independent citizens commission to draw more competitive political boundaries.
We want Democrats and Republicans to come to Sacramento, elected officials whose first commitment is to the public, not to their party. We don't have enough of that today in Sacramento, I'm sorry to say. We have a system that is so gerrymandered that 99% of incumbents are getting reelected in their districts that they drew themselves.
Legislators currently draw their own district boundaries. Outgoing State Assembly Speaker Fabian Nunez has proposed an independent commission, but one that would be chosen in part by the state legislature. For the latest traffic and weather, visit our website at kpcc.org. This is KPCC.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by El Portal Theater, presenting Red Dog Howls, a new drama by Alexander De Nalaris, where one man journeys into his family's past, hoping to save his own future. Starring actress Kathleen Chalfant from Wit and Angels in America, and Matthew Rauch, directed by Michael Peresian. Limited engagement beginning May 14th at El Portal Theater. Tickets at reddoghowls.com.
I'm Pat Morrison. General MacArthur said old soldiers don't die, they just fade away. But former presidents don't fade away, at least not this one. Former President Jimmy Carter has kept himself active in this country and abroad, working on Habitat for Humanity, writing books, and following up on his success in the Mideast peace negotiations when he was in the White House from 1977 through 1981, early 1981, trying to negotiate some kind of understanding in the Mideast as well. We'll be looking at all those issues as we talked to Jimmy Carter about his book, A Remarkable Mother. It's a book, a paean, really, to his mother, Ms. Lillian. But President Carter, first of all, thank you for joining me.
I'm delighted to be with you, Pat, and folks all around who listen.
And on the morning after these two important primaries, I have to ask you, as one of the grand old men of the Democratic Party, what should happen now?
Well, I think the best thing is for both of them to stay in the race and to continue on until the end of the primary season, which will be the first week in June. And I think almost immediately after that, the superdelegates will pretty well coalesce around one of the candidates. And by then, I think the loser will be prepared to support the winner. I think the loser's supporters will also be loyal to the Democratic Party. There may be a few, for instance, who are brand new to politics, like the young folks and maybe some African-Americans that support Obama, that wouldn't want to support, Senator Clinton, but they won't vote for McCain. So I think the Democratic Party is going to come back together quite well.
You are presumably among these superdelegates, and while you've not declared your allegiance, as far as I know, you said your kids are for Obama, your grandkids are for Obama. You must be getting hammered at home.
Well, we have a very highly politically motivated family, and so we have hot debates at all times. But Rosa and I have made a policy since I left the White House of not endorsing a particular Democratic candidate until the season's over.
There have been lots of complaints about how protracted the campaign has been, and is the process designed properly? Is it working properly, or does it need an overhaul?
No, it needs an overhaul. As a matter of fact, after the 2000 debacle, when Al Gore won both the United States and Florida and was deprived of the presidency by the Supreme Court ruling, I served on a major blue ribbon board with President Ford as my co-chairman to analyze how the election law should be revised. And they were substantially changed. And then after the 2004 election, which still had some serious problems, I served with former Secretary of State James Baker. And we made some recommendations which haven't yet been implemented. One of those recommendations, by the way, is to have a series of primaries, four major primaries, almost identical to the time zones of our country, beginning in the East Coast and then going to the Central Zone and then to the mountains and then to the West Coast, and have a primary just for those states alone geographically located. And then the 4 years later, then the East Coast would be the last, and maybe the Central Zone would be first. This is a recommendation that's been made, I think, almost unanimously by the secretaries of state of all the states in the nation. And that's one of the recommendations that we've made. And I hope that it'll be seriously considered and maybe adopted by the two parties before the next election.
What's inherently unfair about the way the primaries work now, do you think?
Well, I don't say they're inherently unfair. I think this time it's been very exciting, titillating to the viewers, distressing to the candidates and maybe some
and
of the supporters.
Expensive.
Yeah, but I don't think there's been any logic about it. And for a candidate to have to go and spend enormous sums of money on television advertising on the East Coast and jump to the West Coast and back to the Midwest and so forth is really a strain on the system. But I think if they could just do a block of states in a particular region, the television, radio coverage, and newspaper coverage would be much more logically used. And it would be an inexorable sort of thing so that everybody would understand ahead of time basically what's going to happen. And then you'd wind up on the West Coast at least the first 4 years with California and Oregon and Washington and maybe Alaska and Hawaii and so forth having those final votes. And then it would rotate every 4 years. That's the idea.
Any chance of this getting embraced, do you think?
I don't know. It'll be how the post-election assessment is made. If the leaders in the two different parties, Republican and Democratic parties, think that this is a system that is so flawed that it needs changing, that would certainly be one of the options to be considered.
You've written a number of books. Now you have this one, A Remarkable Mother, with a picture of you and your mother, whom the world knew as Ms. Lillian during your presidency. There we go. A picture from 1934, I think.
On the back.
Of you and your sister and your mother during the depths of the Depression. Now, when I saw this, I thought you really set a high standard for everybody else for something to do on Mother's Day, because very few of us have written a book for mothers for Mother's Day.
Well, it's not an accident that the book came out just before Mother's Day. I think it's a great Mother's Day present, because my mama just really represented, I think, one of the finest aspects of American citizenship. She was a kind of classic. She didn't mind tearing down parts of society if she thought it was wrong, no matter what anybody said about her. She was courageous. She was dynamic. She was extremely humorous. She did some remarkably funny things. And she, in some ways, was domineering, but sensitive to people she was dominating. And she started off in the Great Depression when we lived in a community in deep South Georgia. We didn't have any white neighbors. All of our neighbors were African Americans. And Mother was a registered nurse, and she soon saw that the people around us had no money to go to the hospital. Before that, she had nursed in a hospital 12 hours a day for $4. But she began to nurse in private homes. And in those days, the nurses put in 20 hours a day in a sick person's home, and they were supposed to get $6 for that. So she would come home at night for years at 10 o'clock at night, and then go back on duty at 2 o'clock that morning, and she would wash her uniforms and take a shower and write instructions for me and my sister what to do the next day.
You wouldn't see her, you'd see the note.
We wouldn't see her, we'd see the note, absolutely. And so that's what Mother did. And when she was 70 years old, she was still trying to take care of the poorest and most dark-skinned and deprived people on earth in the Peace Corps in southern India near Mumbai, which used to be Bombay. So that was her life. And she was an avid politician. She ran Lyndon Johnson's campaign in our county in the most segregated part of America. And he was a scoundrel for most of the white people in our area because of his civil rights moves. But she was his campaign manager, and she really appreciated what he did for poor and black people. That was her life.
The title is A Remarkable Mother. She was also a remarkable woman. I want to talk about some of those things. But she was immensely capable of taking you all down a peg. And there were some remarks that jumped out. For one thing, on inaugural day, she was asked, what do you think of your son? And she said, which one?
Absolutely.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I walked down Pennsylvania Avenue after making my inaugural address, and we sat in a booth and watched the parade go by. And then all of our family were walking toward the White House for the first time. And Jody Powell, my press secretary, shouted out, I don't want anybody in the family to talk to the news media. And Mama stopped. She said, Jody, you can go to hell. I'll speak to whom I please. You can tell Jimmy what to do, but not me. And immediately all the news reporters gathered around my mom, and that's when they asked her the question, aren't you proud of your son? I waited for my mother to give me some very rare accolades, and her response was, which son?
Oh, boy.
She always thought Billy, by the way, was the most intelligent.
She thought he was the one who was reading all the time.
He was, that's true.
Studying. Now, also, she said, sometimes when I look at all my children, I say to myself, Lillian, you should have stayed a virgin.
Yeah, that was when I was president the first year, is when Trivial Pursuit came out, and it was hard to get.
I remember people were going to Canada to buy it.
That's true.
Pharmaceuticals now.
I just could get one copy when I was president for my children. But anyway, one of the first questions on there was, who said, when I look at my children, I wish I had remained a virgin? And the answer was Lillian Carter. So Mama always kept us on our toes. We would have press conferences. I would all during my presidency. And I was wanting to talk about, you know, the Soviet nuclear threat or Middle East peace or the environment and so forth. My first question would often be, Mr. President, how do you react to what your mother said on the Johnny Carson show last night? And I would say, look, I'm not responsible for what my mama says. She's leads her own life, and I can't back up what she said or not.
You lost your mother 25 years ago. What influence does she still exert over you?
A lot. She was a strongly committed civil rights champion 25 or 30 years before Rosa Parks sat in the front of a bus or Martin Luther King Jr. became known. And she helped me campaign for governor and later for president. She was on the reviewing stand when I was governor of Georgia. And I shocked the audience when I made a very brief inaugural speech when I said, I've traveled Georgia more than anyone else has in the past campaigning, and I say to you quite frankly that the time for racial discrimination is over. And a few weeks later, I was on the front cover of Time magazine. And then she also campaigned 5 days a week when I ran for president. And when I made my inaugural address, partially because of my mother's influence, I announced that human rights would be the basic foundation of our foreign policy. So I would say she had a lot of influence on me.
And that still is an obvious priority in your life.
Well, it is. I haven't changed much.
So, she's portrayed throughout the book as formidable. She was hardworking. She went, and just point out, into the Peace Corps when she was in her late 60s. You went there, and there's still people who remember her whose lives were changed by her there.
That's true. One of the key people, one of the final things I got in the book, Rose and I went over there 2 years ago to build homes for Habitat, and I chose a site near where my mother was at. In the Peace Corps, we went by the village to visit them, and now, you know, when I became president, in retrospect, Mama became very famous having been there. So a lot of the people came to meet me in Rosen that I had read about and knew about in Mama's letters home. One of our favorite people was a gardener who gave Mother vegetables and flowers sometimes when she was almost starving. She gave away most of her own food. And she didn't have any way to repay the gardener, so she taught his little six-year-old daughter how to read and write in English. And they took a photograph of them sitting on a rock, and it's on the front cover of the paperback books of my mother. And I wanted to meet the young daughter of the gardener, and they brought her in to meet me, and she's now... She got her Ph.D., and now she's president of a university nearby.
Extraordinary.
It just shows what my mother's influence had on people.
It continued on. Now, you also write about how she influenced your campaigning style when she said she didn't stop talking to people.
Unfortunately, no. Well, it paid off because when Mama went into a little town to make a speech, they never forgot her. They might forget me, but they didn't forget her. She made an indelible impression on people.
Well, and you showed up when you were campaigning, I think, for governor at a wrestling match, and they booed you for interrupting they told the audience that you were Ms. Lillian's son, and then it was all right.
Exactly. She was an avid wrestling fan. She went to wrestling matches every week, professional wrestling. She thought it was all a wonderful sport. And I think her main affinity in sports was for the Dodgers, the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Well, now the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Now the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Because Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier and played
with
them.
That's right. She kept up with Jackie Robinson, who came from a little town near Plains in Georgia. And she and my father were avid baseball fans, and they followed not only the white major leagues, but also the so-called Negro leagues. And she knew when Jackie Robinson was going to play his first game, and so she and my daddy went up to Brooklyn to watch him play under Branch Rickey, the manager. And so she adopted the Dodgers as her team because of them letting Jackie Robinson play.
She was okay with him coming to L.A. too?
She hated to see him move, I think. But she when she came home from the Peace Corps, we bought her one of these enormous 12-foot radio antennas that she put out overlooking her fish pond, and she aimed it so she could get the Dodgers ball games. And so she watched the Dodgers play their last game at night on television. And by then I was president, and she had Tommy Lasorda's telephone number.
Oh, dear.
And on occasion, she would call him on the phone and give him a hard time because he mismanaged the game or because he mistreated one of his young players or something like that. And Tommy Lasorda, whenever I see him these days, he always reminds me that He's glad my mother used to have his phone number, but, you know, he's kind of glad for it to be more quiet now.
My guest is President Jimmy Carter. He is the author of his new book, A Remarkable Mother, about Ms. Lilly and his mother, just in time for Mother's Day. We'll be taking your calls for the former president at 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. He's speaking tonight at 6:30 at Vroman's Bookstore in Pasadena. For more information about that event, go to kpcc.org and click on Pat Morrison. I want to talk about some of your current day activities, your political activities. It is now the 60th anniversary of the State of Israel, which is being celebrated. And I'd like to ask what, from your point of view, Israel has meant to the world and to the United States in those 60 years.
Well, I was present when they celebrated 30th anniversary. And we had a big party on the South Lawn. And Prime Minister Menachem Begin came to the White House for that event. We had about 1,500 people there, a good portion of whom were Jewish rabbis from all over the nation that I invited to that event. And it was on that day that I announced that there was no Holocaust museum or commemoration in America. And I established a 50-person commission to design the Holocaust museum and to raise money for it. And Eddie Bissell became the chairman of that group. And it turned out to be one of the nicest things that I ever did. So this kind of brings back fond memories to me about Israel and its birthdays. And there's no doubt that Israel has set a remarkable example of progress in many, many ways. And I've always been grateful that I had a small role to play in commemorating their birthday.
And as for Israel's role in the world, what was it originally, do you think, and how has it changed over time?
Well, I think at first Israel was struggling. When I became president, there had been four serious wars against Israel in the preceding 25 years. All of those wars had been led by Egypt, the only formidable Arab enemy of Israel. At that time, Egypt was supported by the Soviet Union that gave Egypt weapons and so forth to help them. So I was resolved when I had only been in office a short few days that I would try to bring peace to Israel. So I began to meet with all the leaders from the Middle East. I invited all of them to the United States, except Syria's President Assad wouldn't come. I met him in Geneva, Switzerland. And I found that Sadat was one of those that was willing to negotiate with Israel. So I took them both, as you may remember, to Camp David. We stayed there 13 days and negotiated. And out of that, we came out with the so-called Camp David Accords, which acknowledged that that the Palestinians should have full autonomy and that all the Israeli military and political forces should be removed from the West Bank and Gaza. And then 6 months later, we concluded the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt in the springtime of 1979, 29 years ago, not a word of which has ever been violated.
It stayed to this day.
It stayed to this day, and it's removed permanently, I hope, any threat to Israel from Egypt.
Former President Jimmy Carter is my guest. His book is A Remarkable Mother, about his mother, Ms. Lillian. He will be speaking tonight at Vroman's Books at 6:30. If you want information on that, go to kpcc.org and click on Pat Morrison. We're taking your calls for the former president at 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. And that's what you're listening to, 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the University of California, helping lead the multi-billion-dollar clean tech revolution, providing care to more than 3 million patients a year through its medical centers, and educating 60% of California's med students, our future doctors. UC, what state would we be in without it? Information at universityofcalifornia.edu.
Programming is supported by Kaiser Permanente, offering the advice that a little exercise can do a lot of good. Regular physical activity can help boost the immune system, control appetite, and make you feel more self-confident. Kaiser Permanente. Live well, be well, and thrive.
Good afternoon. It's 1:39. This is 89.3 KPCC. I'm Mark Thomas. LA residents who live in warmer parts of the county could get a break on their utility bills. The Department of Water and Power is considering a 3-tier rate structure. DWP General Manager David Nahai.
it really is to encourage conservation. We don't expect to derive any additional revenue from this, and we certainly hope not to derive any additional revenue from this. Our hope is that the message of conservation will get out loud and clear, and that people will vote with their wallets by just cutting back a little bit on energy use.
Nahai spoke with KPCC's Pat Morrison. Under the utilities plan, hotter zones, including the San Fernando Valley, South Los Angeles, and east of downtown, could use more energy before ratepayers would have to pay more. Cooler places like the West Side, Hollywood, and San Pedro would have a lower use threshold before higher rates kicked in. About a month ago, the LA City Council approved water and electricity increases for DWP. Quick look at traffic in downtown LA. The 110 North is slow and go from 9th Street to the 101. This is 89.3 KPCC.
I'm Pat Morrison. He is a Nobel laureate, a former president of the United States, Jimmy Carter, also the author of A Remarkable Mother, just in time for Mother's Day to make you feel bad for not writing a book about your mother. He will be speaking about his book and signing them tonight, as he reminds me, at Vroman's Books in Pasadena at 6:30. For more information on that, go to kpcc.org and click on Pat Morrison. We're also taking your calls for former President Carter at 866-893-5722. President Carter, part of the news that you have made recently is on your trip to the Mideast to meet with the leaders of Hamas, which has been roundly criticized, as you know. Why did you make that trip? What did you hope for it to accomplish?
Well, I made a trip because it's absolutely necessary for someone to be talking to Hamas, and because there's no way that Israel can ever have peace unless they are involved in the process. And the Carter Center has monitored all three elections that the Palestinians have had. The last one was in 2006, 2 years ago, when Hamas was looked upon by the United States and Israel as very worthy candidates for office. They mounted candidates for seats in the parliament of a Palestinian Authority, and Hamas won. They won a majority of the seats in the parliament, and they were supposed to form a unity government with their opponents in Fatah and other independents. But after that, Israel and the United States decided they did not want a united Palestinian government. So they didn't declare Hamas to be a terrorist organization and forbade anybody to talk to them. Well, it's very important that Hamas get reconciled to Fatah and have a unity government for the Palestinians so someone can represent all the Palestinians in dealing with Israel and bringing peace. It's also important that the president of Syria be involved, whom the United States also has boycotted. So I decided to go and speak to both of them. And my trip was approved by the people of Israel. About a week before I went, there was a public opinion poll just among the Jewish citizens of Israel, not counting the 20% Arabs who are also citizens of Israel. And 64% of the people said that they favored the government of Israel dealing directly with Hamas because they know that Hamas has got to be involved. And the other night, last week, I was on Larry King's show for an interview about my mother's book, and they had one of those CNN polls until midnight, and 70% of the American people said they thought it was the right thing to do. There's no doubt in my mind. And we made a lot of progress.
Hamas is classified as a terrorist organization. Its leaders have pledged themselves to abolish Israel, or certainly to not to acknowledge the existence, the legitimacy of Israel. And people have said, as you know from reading the blogs and the news coverage, why would you want to deal with people who take positions like that?
Well, I think that we were successful in getting Hamas to clarify their position or change it compared to what you just said. I asked Hamas five different things, and they brought in all of their top leaders who were already in Damascus, Syria. And they also brought in the leaders of Hamas from within Gaza. Egypt flew them to Damascus, and they spent all night Saturday and all Sunday and all day Sunday considering the requests or suggestions I made to them, and they gave me their answer to those five requests Sunday night. And I revealed them to the Israeli public and to the news media Monday morning. One of the things that I asked them to do was to accept Israel's right to exist and to live in peace, provided that the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, and the Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Olmert, reached an agreement on a peace agreement. And if the terms of it were submitted to the Palestinian people for in a referendum, that Hamas would accept it, even though Hamas disagreed with the terms. That was one thing. The other thing was the terrible affliction on the little town of Sderot, which is about 20,000 population, in the southern part of Israel, just 3 miles from Gaza. And rockets have been fired on Sderot for the last 7 years. 13 people have been killed. And I went to Sderot and looked at the rudimentary rockets. They're not fancy rockets, but they can be deadly. And over a seven-year period, 13 people have been killed. And I condemn that as an abominable act, and also an act of terrorism. And I made that same point to the Hamas leaders. I condemned it very strongly, and I suggested that they either have a unilateral ceasefire or that they have a ceasefire mutually with Israel just dealing with Gaza. This is something that Hamas had never been willing to do before, because they had always insisted that a ceasefire had to be Gaza plus the West Bank, and Israel refused to acknowledge a ceasefire in the West Bank. So after I left, through the Egyptians, who are negotiating every day between Israel and Hamas, by the way, the Egyptians proposed that there be a ceasefire just in Gaza. So far, the Israelis have not accepted this proposal by Hamas. I hope that they will. The Egyptian negotiator, I understand, is now on the way to Jerusalem to try to encourage the Israelis to accept the ceasefire. That would stop all the rockets.
You said that the United States and Israel forbade anyone from talking to Hamas, and there's some question as to what the State Department told you. Condi Rice said that the Bush administration explicitly warned you against meeting with members of Hamas, and you said that didn't happen.
Oh, it didn't.
Why is there, is it apples and oranges on something
seems
pretty clear?
I've made a public statement that I consider Secretary Rice to be an honorable person. I'm sure she wouldn't deliberately make a false statement, but her statement that she's making is incorrect, is false. I put in a telephone call to her, which I always do before I go to a sensitive area of the world. The Carter Center has programs in 71 nations on Earth. And instead of her returning my call, she was in Europe traveling. And so one of her deputies called me, and we had a very pleasant 20-minute conversation. He never said or suggested that I not go. He never suggested that I not talk to the president of Syria or to Hamas. And that's the only conversation I've ever had with anybody in the U.S. government.
Well, take your calls for former President Jimmy Carter at 866-893-5722. Karen is calling from San Marino. Karen, go ahead.
Oh, President Carter, what a treat that you're on Pat's show. I bought your book, Palestine Peace, Not Apartheid, after I saw you on Democracy Now.
Yes, good.
And, boy, did I appreciate that. I remember in 77 going to Israel as a young Jewish teenager and just being horrified at the poverty and economic isolation of the Palestinians. And I was so glad to have your history and understand that. But I have a question.
Please.
The two-state solution seems to me like it just has to be on the pathway towards having one state where everybody's treated equally, because two states would just keep economic inequality, and then how would you stop poverty from creating extremism?
Well, I think the Israelis would not ever want to see a one-state solution, because it's now, as you know, officially a Jewish state. Any person who's a Jew, who is Jewish, can come back in and have full citizenship in Israel, but others cannot. So if it was just one state in all of the Holy Land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, in just the next few years, a majority of the population would be non-Jewish and could outvote the Jewish citizens and change all the structures of the Jewish state if everybody was given one person, one vote rights. So that's something that the Jews will not accept in Israel, in my opinion. And I think the two-state solution can work if the borders are clearly identified and if the Israelis withdraw from the occupied territories, from West Bank as well as Gaza. And then, of course, the entire world can help the Palestinians rejuvenate their land. Nowadays, a good portion of the West Bank has been taken by Israeli settlers, and they have taken the choice spots in the West Bank. They've taken the hilltops and they've taken the most lush and productive land, cropland and grazing land. So I think if the Palestinians have the right to access to the outside world and a reasonable chance, they can be reasonably successful economically.
Karen, thanks so much for your call. In Irvine, Ray is calling. Let's see. Ray, go ahead.
Hi, Pat. Thanks for taking my call. President Carter, this is such an honor. I really appreciate the chance to speak with you, sir.
Thank you, Pat.
I wish to express my gratitude and admiration for you for everything you've done. I'm aware of the work you did for the river blindness in Africa, and that was a phenomenal effort. Sir, in light of your recent trip to the Mideast, I am wondering what you thought of the entire outcome and how encouraged and discouraged you are with what happened. And I was wondering if you think that model, that initiative, is portable in the sense that it could be taken to India and Pakistan or China and Tibet, perhaps to the two Koreas. And I would love to hear what you think about it.
Ray, thanks for your call.
Which model do you think he was talking about?
He was talking about the Mideast model that you're working on. I think the idea of the two-state.
Well, I think in every case, Ray, when you have two adversaries that don't get along or on the verge of war or are already involved in combat, the best thing to do is to talk to them and to try to have a mediator involved who has to be trusted by both sides. This is something that the Carter Center does quite often. As a matter of fact, on the way back from Nepal, I stopped in the Mideast and made this highly publicized trip. But in the Nepalese situation, they had a civil war going on there for 12 years, and the Carter Center was involved in mediating a peace agreement for the last 5 years. And it was very successful in that we had an honest and fair and safe election on the 10th of April. And the Nepalese are now forming a brand new government, and they're involving human rights for the first time for outcast people, including untouchables, who would now be given an equal chance in life. So in every case where there is an ongoing threat of war, good mediation and conversing with those on both sides is a very crucial, I think, a necessary step.
Ray, thanks very much for your call. In Costa Mesa, Terry's calling. Terry, go ahead.
Mr. Carter, in reference to your book, Freedom Not Apartheid, it seems to me that the still small voice of truth and reason have been drowned out by the sound of the wheel against which you're grinding your axe. And I'd like to know what the real source of your obvious bias is.
Okay, Terry, thank you. The obvious bias being?
Against Israel and pro-Palestinian.
Okay, thank you, Terry.
My bias is toward peace and justice only, and it's not against Israel or it's not against the Palestinians or for either one in preference to the other. I've worked for 32 years, Terry, trying to bring peace to Israel, and have been partially successful, as you may have heard on Pat's show a few minutes ago. And my book, if you look at the title of it, is Palestine, not Israel. Palestine, peace, not apartheid. And so it's not designed at all to be critical of Israel. And within the book, everything in it is completely accurate. And also, I advocate in there my own ideas on what would be the foundation for peace between Israel and its neighbors. And it's encompassed, if you want to look it up, in a proposal called the Geneva Accords. I was a keynote speaker there, and there were about 800 people from Israel and Palestine there that was revealed in the winter of 2003. And this outlines in quite some detail what can be done to give both Israel and the Palestinians a peace and justice. And it's fair. One of the things that I might add very quickly is that the arrangements would leave about 500,000, roughly half, of the Israeli settlers that are now on Palestinian land. It would leave them there. It would leave half of them on Palestinian land and swap an equivalent amount of land just east of Gaza.
Okay. Eli is calling from West Los Angeles. Eli, go ahead.
Hi. Yes, my name is Eli. I'm with the American Jewish Committee. My question to is Israel is willing to negotiate a two-state solution, but after 60 years of existence, it should not have to negotiate its right to survive. That is the negotiation that Hamas, which the United States and among others has called a terrorist organization, wants to have. And by meeting with Hamas, don't you legitimize their position that Israel should have to bargain for its right to survive?
All right,
and
Eli, let's put that question to President Carter. We're running out of time. We'd like to get a couple more questions in.
Two things right quickly, Eli. First of all, I didn't legitimize Hamas by going to meet with them. They were legitimized by the fact that their candidates ran in an honest and open and fair election sponsored by the United States and Israel, and they won a majority of the votes. They were legitimized by the approval of their own people. Secondly, Hamas, as I just described a while ago, has said they will accept Israel's right to exist, to live in peace, provided that the agreement is worked out between Israel and the Palestinian leaders, Mahmoud Abbas, and it's approved by the Palestinian people in a referendum. In addition to that, all 22 Arab countries have voted three times now, including the last time in Damascus this past fall, to recognize Israel's right to exist and to live in peace, to have diplomatic relations with all the Arab countries, and also normal trade relationships if Israel will withdraw to its 67 borders or those borders modified by mutual agreement. So I think that explains the situation quite clearly.
President Carter, we've only got about a minute or so left. What do you think the impact of the Iraq War has been and will be on the U.S. both at home and abroad?
Well, it's been a devastating impact on the United States. It was an erroneous war, unnecessary war. It was based on false statements. Whether the administration leaders knew they were false or not, I don't have any way to ascertain. And I hope that we'll get out of it as soon as possible. As a matter of fact, one of the finest Blue Ribbon commissions ever formed in America was by Lee Hamilton and by James Baker, one Democrat, one Republican, one former Secretary of State. And it had 1 year to study that situation and recommended what ought to be done to get us out of Iraq. It involves a time certain to withdraw. I don't care if it's 1 year or 4 years. That's not important. But to let the Iraqi people know that we will be out of Iraq at a certain time. This puts the full responsibility on them to get their own eggs in order. And the second major recommendation of this commission was that all the countries around that area should be involved in pledging to the Iraqi people, we will support you as you take over the responsibility for your economy, for your military capabilities, and also for your politics. And I would also bring in France and Russia and others to let the Iraqi people know. That's the basic approach to success in Iraq.
Former President Jimmy Carter, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize and founder of the Carter Center, will be speaking tonight, signing books at 6:30 at Vroman's Bookstore in Pasadena. His book, A Remarkable Mother, about his mother, Ms. Lillian. You've all got wonderful calls. I'm sorry we couldn't get to them. Alfonso in Temple City, your high points and low points. So many people still would like to talk to you. President Carter, thank you so much for coming in today.
Well, I hope to be with you again, Pat. Thank you for letting me come.